Risk communication. Okay, I just got a recording in progress announcement. I'm going to be talking about risk communication generically for the most part, and hopefully its application to public health and to the work you're doing in the course will be reasonably obvious as I go along, given my focus on COVID in the last couple of years and Mike's focus on COVID. I will intersperse some COVID comments and end with a slide about COVID in particular, but this is not going to be a presentation on COVID risk communication. It's going to be a presentation on generic risk communication, or at least my approach to generic risk communication. Next slide, please. And I want to start with the traditional definition of risk, the definition that risk assessors use and engineers use. And it's very straightforward. It's a multiplication of two things: magnitude, how bad is it when it happens, times probability, how likely is it to happen. And you get your best measure of the magnitude of a risk, your best measure of the probability of that risk. You multiply them by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. And that's what risk assessors mean by risk. Next slide, please. And back in the 1980s, I came up with a new definition. I started realizing that what risk assessors mean by risk isn't what normal people mean by risk. It's not even what risk assessors mean by risk when they go home at night. So I started trying to figure out what normal people mean by risk, and I coined the formula that sent my children to college and is going to send my grandchildren to college someday. Next slide, please. And it starts by taking what risk assessors mean by risk, the multiplication of magnitude times probability, and I redefined that as hazard. They have a different definition for hazard, but playing fast and loose with their vocabulary, I said, all right, let's call what they call risk, let's call that hazard. Next slide, please. And I introduced a new term that I consider to be part of risk. And that new term is in my judgment, what ordinary people, what normal people mean by risk. And that term is outrage. Now, I have to say, when I introduced the term outrage, I was working mostly on environmental controversies, and outrage worked very well as a word to describe what people are feeling at a public meeting in the vicinity of a polluting chemical factory, let's say. And there they are at the meeting yelling about how the factory is giving them cancer. And their mix of anger and fear was very nicely captured by the word outrage. And now it's my term. It's my jargon, and I'm stuck with it, and I don't want to change it. But I have to say, it doesn't capture all of what I mean very well, because what I mean by outrage, it includes anger, it includes fear, it includes fear's wimpy cousin concern. But it includes other ways of being upset as well. It includes, for example, misery, which is a very major part of what I'm calling outrage vis-a-vis the pandemic, where, you know, obviously fear is also relevant, but a lot of people aren't that frightened. They are miserable at this ongoing disruption of their lives that constitutes the pandemic. So that's part of what I mean by outrage. And so is guilt and shame and a whole bunch of other things. Basically, if you are upset about a risk, whatever it is that's causing you to be upset, that's what I mean by outrage. And using those two words, I coined the formula for which I am, I guess, as famous as I'm going to be. It's for that formula. Next slide, please. And that is, straightforwardly, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, I didn't mean that plus sign literally, but as I worked with engineers and as I worked with technical people in a variety of fields, I could see them muttering to each other, you know, that's what you get when you let a humanities major write a formula. They hate that plus sign. They find, you know, and they would say, no, it's not plus, it's times, and it's not, you know, it's not really quite times either. So I came up with a different version of the formula that engineers like much better. Next slide, please. Risk is a function of hazard and outrage. And, you know, I mean, that they like, that they don't mind, because it doesn't say what the function is. It just says hazard and outrage are both part of what we mean by risk. Now, I want to stay on this slide for a couple of minutes and talk about what this formula means to me, or means in my judgment. I want to start by pointing out that the correlation between hazard and outrage is extremely low. It's about 0.2. And if you've taken a statistics course, you may remember that you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. You square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance, which is basically nothing. So what I'm saying is, if you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. So we've got these two variables that collectively account for risk that are essentially unrelated to each other. But they have a complicated relationship that goes to the heart of risk communication, and that is this: although the correlation between outrage and hazard is very low, the correlation between outrage and perceived hazard is quite high. It's about 0.7, accounting for roughly half the variance. So outrage and hazard perception are genuinely linked. Anytime you get a correlation that high, a correlation around 0.7 or higher, the question you ask if you're any kind of scientist at all is, what's the causal structure of that correlation? As you all know, correlation is not causality. So now that we know that they're linked correlationally, the question is, what's the causal structure? Is outrage a cause of hazard perception, or is hazard perception a cause of outrage? And it turns out the answer is both are true. It's a cycle, and there are arrows in both directions, but the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is quite weak, and the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong. Okay, that is, for the most part, it is not true that outrage, I'm sorry, that hazard perception is the engine of outrage. It is much truer that outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Okay, so that's important. So that, you know, if people are outraged, they are going to perceive the hazard as high. If people are not outraged, they are going to perceive the hazard as low. And that's true independent of the actual hazard. So outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage, and hazard isn't the engine of anything. Now, hazard is important. The last thing I want to do is talk to a class in public health and tell you, don't worry about whether people are dying. Hazard is important, but it's important for its own sake. It has essentially no relationship to hazard perception and no relationship to outrage. But those two are yoked at the hip, and they're yoked with an unexpected causal relationship. Outrage is mostly cause, and hazard perception is mostly effect. Now, that is, in my judgment, the most important thing to know about risk communication. And that opens up Pandora's box. That opens up a lot of understanding, and it also opens up a lot of confusion. And in order to begin to make sense out of all of that, the next thing I want to do, and in some ways the most important thing I want to do, is now graph hazard against outrage. Next slide, please. So there we have a nice empty graph of hazard against outrage. And bear in mind, given that the correlation is extremely low, if you put dots in this graph to represent all kinds of different risks, there would be dots all over the graph. That's what a low correlation means. There are some dots in the high hazard, low outrage corner. There are some dots in the low hazard, high outrage corner. There are dots in all four corners. There are dots in the middle. There are dots everywhere. That's what a low correlation is. But I want to look at the corners. And I want to start with the lower right-hand corner. Next slide, please. And that is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. Okay, that is the hazard is high, the outrage is low, people are insufficiently upset. This is the traditional venue of public health. It's the traditional venue of health communication, of safety communication. It's the corner of the graph where we're all most comfortable trying to tell people to take risks more seriously. The very essence of this paradigm of risk communication is watch out. You're telling people to watch out, to be more careful, to take precautions. Next slide, please. And in ways that I hope you understand, given what I've already said about the causal structure here, the essence of precaution advocacy is that arrow to try to increase the outrage. Now, you're not trying to increase the outrage for the hell of it. You're trying to increase the outrage because you understand the causal structure you're working in. You're trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to increase people's willingness to take precautions or tolerate precautions or demand precautions. So because the hazard is high, you want the outrage to be high in order to get the hazard perception high and thus commensurate with the actual hazard. If I had a whole course or even a whole class in that course to teach you about how to do precaution advocacy, we would be talking at great length about the fact that low outrage, a synonym for low outrage is apathy. People are apathetic. And the implications for that for precaution advocacy is they have a short attention span, so you have to keep your message short. You have to repeat your message a lot because they're not really paying attention. You have to keep it simple because if you make it complicated, they're going to zone out. You have to make it interesting if you possibly can in order to try to seduce more attention. You find a variety of ways to motivate them to get more interested. Maybe you try to directly arouse outrage, to arouse fear, or to arouse anger or other kinds of outrage. Maybe you try to appeal to existing outrage so that you try to make a case that something they're already outraged about applies in this situation. Maybe you try to appeal to needs instead to get them to take precautions based on needs rather than based on outrage. But somehow you're going to try to motivate precaution taking in an apathetic audience. This is a well-developed field. It's a big piece of health education. It's a big piece of very traditional risk communication. It goes all the way back to Aristotle. But I have to tell you that everything we know about precaution advocacy is largely ignored by most of public health. Most people in public health equate precaution advocacy with hazard education. So that I have had health department clients for 40 years that will say to me, I want people to take precautions, but I don't want to scare them. And that's kind of like saying, I want to tie one hand behind my back and then tie my shoes. It's very hard to get people to take precautions without scaring them. It's not totally impossible. You can pay them. There are other things you can do to try to get people to take precautions. But arousing outrage is by far the most productive way to get people to take precautions. It is, in my judgment, the essence of precaution advocacy, and most of public health doesn't want to do it. So if I leave you with nothing else, I want to leave you with the idea that if you're going to go into public health, you're going to spend a lot of your career trying to get people to take precautions. Wrap your mind now around either the idea that you're going to want to scare people or the idea that you're going to tie one hand behind your back throughout your career, and take your choice between those two. Very briefly, let me say some things about COVID precaution advocacy in particular. Next slide, please. Obviously, in the early months of the pandemic, when most people didn't know about the pandemic or weren't yet scared about COVID, precaution advocacy was the most important thing to do. Many officials unwisely spent that period doing outrage management instead. That is, they were busy saying calm down when they should have been saying watch out. Precaution advocacy is also important in COVID when people overestimate good news. For example, people who relax too much after they're vaccinated and no longer want to take the non-pharmaceutical precautions that are appropriate, or people who underestimate bad news, they shrug off a new variant. So even after a pandemic has begun, there are opportunities for precaution advocacy. I want to warn you about the risk of mistaking outrage at the precaution for apathy about the risk. If you've got people who are not getting vaccinated because they're terrified of the vaccine, scaring them more about the virus is probably not what you need to be doing. What you need to be doing is figuring out how to calm them down about the vaccine, so that you have to pay attention to whether if people are not taking precautions, are they outraged at the precaution or are they apathetic about the risk? I also want to warn you about the risk of thinking people are apathetic when they're actually in denial. In general, you want to arouse outrage in order to get people to take precautions. But when outrage is unbearably high, people trip an emotional circuit breaker and they stop taking precautions, or they take the wrong precautions. They get paralyzed. At that point, if you think they're apathetic and you try to scare them, you will push them more deeply into denial. Denial is unusual. Denial is the zebra, the horse is apathy. Usually when people seem apathetic, they are apathetic. But I did want to warn you that occasionally denial is what you're up against, and that calls for a very different set of strategies. A point that isn't on this slide, that if I were redoing the slide, I would put on the slide, is that people get sick of precaution advocacy. And that's partly relevant to COVID right now, but it's relevant to anybody who's pursuing a career in public health, that people get tired of being warned. They get desensitized to the warnings. They are already aware of the risk and have decided they don't care much about it and they don't want to take precautions. And continuing to warn people when they are no longer interested in your warnings, and it's not that they haven't heard them, they have heard them and they're sick of them. The continuing to warn people becomes at best useless and maybe even harmful. In trying to get people to take the precautions you're aiming at. So you need to ration your precaution advocacy. You need to use it wisely. If people are sick of it, you need to figure out what to do instead. Are you going to just escalate and warn them ever more aggressively? Do you need a different approach? Should you at least acknowledge that they are sick of hearing that they should wear their damn mask? or they're sick of hearing that they should get another booster. There are ways of talking to people who are sick and tired of precaution advocacy, and that's something we need to think about. I think that's all I want to say about precaution advocacy. So let's go to the next corner of the graph. Next slide, please. Now we're in the opposite corner. We're now looking at risks that are high in outrage and low in hazard. And this is the venue of what I call outrage management. People are upset, but not endangered. And if the essence of precaution advocacy is watch out, the essence of outrage management is calm down. But the message isn't calm down, because calm down isn't the calming message. When you talk to people who are very upset and you say calm down, they don't get calmer. They get irritated at you for saying calm down, especially if you say calm down, you hysterical fool, or if your tone of voice or your nonverbal communication suggests that what you're saying is what an idiot they are for being so upset. So calm down is almost never the message. But it is indeed the essence of the paradigm. And another way of saying that, next slide, please, is, of course, this arrow. Just as, in my judgment, the core of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage, the core of outrage management is to try to decrease the outrage. Okay. And again, my clients don't like that. Instead of calming people down, they want to teach people that the hazard isn't serious. And just as in precaution advocacy, teaching apathetic people that this is a serious hazard doesn't work very well. They're not listening. They're not interested. In outrage management, teaching people that it's not a serious hazard doesn't work very well. It's not that they're not interested. It's that they don't believe you. Outraged people don't want to hear you tell them that they shouldn't be outraged. And this goes back to the sort of the core of my original work with environmental controversies, where you're at a public meeting and the neighbors of the polluting factory are absolutely convinced that the pollution is giving them cancer. And up in the front of the room is an expert saying, no, we've done a quantitative risk assessment on this risk. And the odds that the amount of dimethyl meatloaf coming out of this factory stacks are going to cause significant amounts of cancer in the community are, one in a million. It's a tiny risk. You took a higher risk driving to the meeting than this factory imposes on you. And the more that expert speaks, the angrier the audience gets. And the more upset the audience gets, and eventually somebody stands up in the back of the room and says, "You're lying. We're all going to die of leukemia." And there's tumultuous applause. Okay. And I've been to hundreds of meetings like this, and you ask yourself, what does it take to applaud the idea that you're going to die of leukemia? And the answer is outraged. When people are outraged enough, they would rather believe you're going to die of leukemia than believe you're not the Antichrist after all. And under those circumstances, it is very difficult to convince them that they're not going to die of leukemia. They want to die of leukemia. Or to make the point more carefully, they want to believe they're going to die of leukemia so they can hang on to their outrage at you. Now, that's not the core of public health, but that happens in public health. If you're a responsible, and I'm sure Mike will tell you this, if you're a responsible public health professional, you spend more time scaring people than you do reassuring people. But, from time to time, not that rarely in your career, you encounter people who are excessively alarmed about a risk that you as an expert know is trivial. And there you are at that public meeting telling them to calm down. And there they are yelling at you and getting angrier and angrier and more outraged because you haven't learned outrage management. It's a completely different toolkit than the precaution advocacy toolkit. It involves a lot of listening. It involves a lot of echoing. It involves a lot of validating, acknowledging the truth of that portion of what they're upset about that's true. You know, so if they're 90% wrong and they're 10% right and you're 90% right and you're in the room telling them that you want to tell them about your 90%, but what you really have to do is spend a lot of time talking about their 10%, saying, you know, you're right about this and you're right about that. And if they're not right about the hazard, they're almost always right about the outrage. They're right that, you know, you've been ignoring them. They're right that your company or your agency hasn't been listening. They're right that you haven't been responsive. So there are aspects of the hazard that they're right about. Yeah, it is true that the vaccine sometimes causes, you know, myocarditis. There are aspects of the hazard that they're right about. There are certainly aspects of the outrage that they're right about. So strategies of outrage management involve things like acknowledging your prior misbehavior, staking out the middle, acknowledging the portion of the truth that where they're right and you're wrong. It means acknowledging your current problems. It means giving away credit if they have pushed you to make certain changes in policy. It's awfully tempting after having been pressured into making those changes to pretend you made them because you wanted to. But if you want to do outrage management, you want to acknowledge that they pushed for those changes and they succeeded in getting you to make those changes. It involves sharing control, setting up community advisory panels and other kinds of instruments and other kinds of mechanisms to share control. These are all tools of outrage management. It's a completely different toolkit than precaution advocacy. It's a less obvious toolkit. It's less in your wheelhouse as a public health professional than precaution advocacy. Precaution advocacy is what you do every day. Outrage management is what you do once or twice a month. But when that once or twice a month comes, you better know how to do it. Next slide, please. Some aspects of outrage management vis-a-vis COVID. Obviously, vaccine hesitant people who are fearful of possible side effects or mistrustful of the experts vis-a-vis the vaccine. Political polarizations more generically. It seems to me that much of COVID has been characterized by both camps' real or imagined or exaggerated grievances against the other. I give you a long list of ways in which public health has pissed off particularly the political right. And certainly you're probably more familiar with ways that the political right has pissed off public health. So that there's outrage in both directions and there's need for outrage management. Certainly during lulls, and we're in a lull right now, people become excessively alarmed. You may need outrage management during the lull to get them to enjoy the lull, to get them to take the opportunity to relax their precautions on board. People may be having trouble finding their way to the new normal, or if it's just a lull, the temporary new normal. So, you know, I mean, if you think of COVID as having waves, and I think we're pretty much all familiar with the waves, every time you're in a down cycle, you need to help people who didn't notice you're in a down cycle relax, and that's outrage management. And you also need to help people who aren't aware of the fact that there's going to be an up cycle again, prepare for that. And so you're going to need some precaution advocacy and outrage management with different groups of people at the same time. Something that I didn't put on this slide, but that I could easily put on the slide, is characteristically after a crisis, you almost always need outrage management. during a crisis, people keep their outrage to themselves. If you're going to save their life, they don't want to yell at you that you should have kept this from happening in the first place. But one of the defining characteristics of the end of a crisis is people are no longer so terrified, and they can now afford their recriminations. So when people start being, and I can see Mike nodding his head, when people start being angry at your agency for having screwed up the crisis, that's when you know the crisis is kind of over, or at least over for now, that they're no longer counting on you to save them. And now they can afford to tell you what a crappy job you did. So one of the characteristics, one of the moments for outrage management is post-crisis. Almost always need outrage management after a crisis is over. I think that's all I want to say about that. Next slide, please. This is a convenient point, I think, to interrupt the chart of hazard against outrage to tell you some of the components of outrage. And here's a list of 12 principal components. And the chart is labeled safe versus risky because I'm trying to convince you that low outrage is one way of being safe and high outrage is one way of being risky. Obviously, low hazard is a different way of being safe. High hazard is a different way of being risky. So if risk is voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, and chronic, and there are six more on the next slide, but let's stay on this slide for a minute. If it's all the things on the left-hand side of the slide, people are going to be calm even if it's killing them. And if the risk is coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and catastrophic, people are going to be very upset even if the hazard is very low. So you can use this chart to predict outrage. By asking yourself how much outrage is implicit in this particular situation. And you can use this chart to manage outrage. You can start identifying what are the components of outrage that if I'm trying to get it higher are most available for me to exacerbate. How do I make people more aware of this, how coerced this risk is or how memorable it is or how dreaded it is if I'm trying to scare them more. Or if I'm trying to reassure them, how do I, make it more familiar? How do I, make it more voluntary? What can I do? Which of the components is most available to me to diminish that component of outrage in order to calm people down and get them less demanding of precautions I think are unnecessary? Next slide, please. This is just the other half of the previous slide. If a risk is knowable, individually controlled, fair, morally irrelevant, if the sources are trustworthy, if the process is responsive, those are all going to be components of low outrage, and their opposites: unknowable, controlled by others, unfair, morally relevant, the sources are untrustworthy, the process is unresponsive. That's all ways of, that outrage is high. I have to say this is an oversimplified model. All I'm doing is listing components. We don't have an algorithm. We don't have a regression equation for these 12 components, and there's actually more than 12. But it's not like I can give you the numbers to stick in front of each of these components. The components are individually measurable. With survey research, you can find out how fair or unfair people think it is, or how voluntary or involuntary they think it is. All 12 of these, there are survey research tools for measuring them. What we don't know is how to add them up. We can do something very rough and just count how many of them seem high. And if 8 or 9 or 10 of them are high, you're going to have high outrage. And you'll either be glad you have high outrage if the hazard's also high, or you'll be unhappy you have high outrage if the hazard's low. But if you got 9 or 10 of these, the outrage is going to be high. If you got 2 or 3 of them, the outrage is going to be low. So you can predict it, and you can manage it, but you know, you can't measure it very precisely because we don't know the regression equations. We don't know the numbers, the weightings to put in front of these 12 factors. Generically, I think the big three are usually control, trust, and responsiveness. And they're all on this second half, whether I control the risk or somebody else does, whether I can trust you or not, whether the process is responsive to my concerns or not. Those are the big three generically, but I have worked in issues where those weren't the big three at all. With radiation, for example, dread is one of the big three. Anytime catastrophic potential is high, that's going to be one of the big three. So, you know, you can't count on control, trust, and responsiveness to be the big three. You have to actually ask yourself, what are the major sources of outrage in this particular situation? And what can I do to manage the outrage up or to manage the outrage down so that I get it commensurate with what I consider to be the size of the hazard? Okay, next slide, please. I want to go back to the chart now and go to the upper right-hand corner. Now we're in the venue of risks that are high in both outrage and hazard. People are endangered and they are also upset. Okay, and this is the third paradigm, which is, of course, crisis communication. So in precaution advocacy, the essence of the paradigm is watch out. In outrage management, the essence of the paradigm is calm down. In crisis communication, the essence of the paradigm is we'll get through this together. Okay, next slide, please. And what what's important about this slide is there's no arrow. You're not trying to increase the outrage because it's already high. You're not trying to reduce the outrage because it's supposed to be high. And that's the point I really want to emphasize, because my clients, especially my clients in public health, spend most of their careers trying to get people upset, okay, trying to do precaution advocacy. And then along comes a crisis. And finally, people are rightly upset, and you get upset that they're upset, and you start trying to calm them down, which is crazy. You know, they are rightly upset. This is a dangerous risk. They think it's dangerous. They're freaking out about it. The fact that they're freaking out about it is the motivator for them to take precautions. And it's, you know, the cardinal sin in crisis communication is to act as if it were outrage management. Okay? And it's a sin that public health agencies commit all the time. And you saw it in COVID. You know, you saw public health agencies when people were apathetic, public health was trying to scare them. That's good. When people got appropriately scared, public health people started trying to calm them down again, and that was a mistake. You know, what you need to do is tolerate that high level of outrage, which is functional, which is going to motivate the precautions. What you want, if you imagine a bisect, if you imagine a dotted line from the origin going up through crisis communication, you want everybody on that line. You want outrage that's commensurate with the hazard, because the outrage is going to determine the hazard perception, and you want the hazard perception commensurate with the hazard. So if the hazard perception and the outrage are too low, you're doing precaution advocacy. If they're too high, you're doing outrage management. If the outrage is high and the hazard is also high, it's already commensurate and there's no arrow. You've got no reason to change the level of outrage, but there's still communication to be done. Okay, people are upset, but now what you want to do, three things. One, you want to validate their outrage. Okay, instead of telling them to calm down, you want to tell them how right they are to be upset. You know, of course you're upset. This is upsetting. We're upset too. That's number one. Number two, you want to help them bear it. You want to help them bear the situation, and you want to help them bear their outrage, which means you have to bear their outrage. Okay. And number three, and most important, you want to guide them through it. Okay. The fact that they're appropriately outraged means they are open to taking precautions. Doesn't mean they'll take the right ones. You know, they may take the wrong ones, and they are highly dependent on your expertise to guide them as to the right way to respond to the crisis. What I'm emphasizing is the right way to respond to the crisis isn't calming down, isn't becoming less outraged. It's figuring out which precautions are most appropriate. Okay, next slide, please. So where does crisis communication, what role does crisis communication play in COVID? Obviously, it's the main task throughout the pandemic. The pandemic is a crisis. People are, for the most part, upset. I've already emphasized that some people some of the time aren't upset enough. Some people some of the time are too upset. So there is COVID precaution advocacy to be done. There is COVID outrage management to be done. But most of what you're doing in a crisis is crisis communication. And a pandemic is obviously a paradigmatic crisis. Next slide, please. So I want to talk very briefly, because I don't, you know, I'm sensitive to the time, about some of the generic crisis communication recommendations that are especially relevant to COVID. And if you've read some of what I've written for SIDRAP about COVID crisis communication, these are already familiar. And I'm not going to go into any detail about them, but I want to at least list them. Don't over reassure. And the more extreme version of don't over reassure, err on the alarming side. It is better to be too scary than not scary enough. Acknowledge uncertainty. And that's been a big problem in COVID. Experts have been, Mike is a notable exception, but most experts have been much too confident sounding. And it's hard to acknowledge uncertainty, which is why I say even proclaim it. You have to aggressively insist on uncertainty for people to actually get the message. Share dilemmas, talk about the challenges of the pandemic and the endless dilemmas of trying to compromise public health against other goods and other kinds of dilemmas. Don't fake consensus, which is kind of a correlate of acknowledging uncertainty. Respectfully acknowledge opinion diversity. There are other experts who don't agree with me about this, and they have expertise too. Be willing to speculate. You will see in crisis communication often advice not to speculate. And to me, that's crazy advice. I mean, the essence of speculation is talking about uncertain probabilities, and the essence of risk communication is talking about uncertain probabilities. So, I mean, the idea of, you know, I mean, how you do risk communication without speculating is beyond me. My model for responsible speculation is like weather forecasters when the hurricane is coming. They speculate on how bad it might be, and they speculate on where it might go, but they are careful to be clear that they're speculating. They are not sure, and they give you graphs that say, you know, here's the map of where it might go, and, you know, tune in later. But what they don't do is saying, how should we know where the hurricane's going to come? Come back in 48 hours and we'll tell you where it went. That's irresponsible risk communication. And, you know, they fully understand that talking about the future is the core of risk communication. And if you're going to be in public health, you're going to have to talk about the future. And since you can't predict the future with confidence, you're going to be speculating without confidence. You're going to be speculating tentatively. Next bullet, to validate people's fear, misery, and other emotions. I've already said that, you know, validating outrage is part of the core of crisis communication. Establish your own humanity, and that includes your own fear and misery. You're not an objective expert guiding a frightened public. You are a frightened expert guiding a frightened public. And you can bear it, and that models being able to bear it for them. If you're not scared, then you're not a good model of how to bear being scared. So letting your fear show and then showing that you can bear it is much better crisis communication. Next slide, please. Tell people what to expect. That's anticipatory guidance. Offer people things to do and choices of things to do, a whole menu of things to do, ideally. Acknowledge and apologize for errors and deficiencies and misbehaviors. And that's been a big problem, it seems to me, throughout the pandemic, is experts get stuff wrong, which is inevitable, but they don't want to talk about getting stuff wrong, and they certainly don't want to apologize for it. Be explicit about changes in official prediction, opinion, or policy. Last but by far not least, don't lie and don't tell half truths. Aim for total candor. If you go onto my website, the most recent of the 64 things I posted on COVID so far is something I posted a week ago entitled Public Health Tells Noble Lies. And I think public health has gotten caught telling noble lies in the pandemic. And it has been very costly to public trust. So that's all pieces of crisis communication. These are all generic crisis communication recommendations, but I've cherry-picked the ones that seem to me most relevant to the pandemic. Next slide, please. And we're nearing the end here. Down in the bottom left-hand corner of the map is low hazard, low outrage, and I'm not going to put a circle there. I have not found that to be a profit opportunity. I mean, back when I was in the business of risk communication, when I did risk communication for a living, I did a lot of outrage management, which paid extremely well. I did a lot of precaution advocacy and crisis communication, which didn't pay nearly as well, but were important for my soul and for the benefit of the public. But you know, down in the lower left-hand corner, there's no risk communication to be done, right? I mean, what would you say to people? You know, congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right, this is trivial. If people are not worried about a risk that is not serious, why would you talk to them about it? Okay. On the other hand, okay, if people are temporarily not worried, but they're gonna get worried, then you might wanna do some sort of preemptive outrage management. And if they're not endangered now, but they're likely to become endangered in the future, then you might wanna do some preparedness, some precaution advocacy in advance of the hazard. And if both are gonna happen, then you're in the world of pre-crisis communication. So this map is a snapshot. And if you're in the lower left-hand corner in your snapshot, but looking ahead, you foresee being in one of the other three corners in the future, then you may well have occasion to do some risk communication, even though you're in the lower left-hand corner. But if you're going to stay in the lower left-hand corner, then I would suggest that it's not an opportunity for risk communication of any great importance. Next slide, please. Right in the middle, we have what I call the sweet spot, and this is arguably a fourth paradigm. You could call it stakeholder engagement or public participation. This is talking to people who are interested rather than either apathetic or upset about a risk that is, you know, worth paying attention to, but certainly not a crisis, not urgent, not huge. So it's intermediate in hazard and it's intermediate in outrage. You are educating people who are interested, okay? And I used to not think of this as a paradigm at all, because it's, to me, it's sort of neutral. But it is a paradigm. I mean, stakeholder engagement is important, and it's worth doing. Late in my career, I got more and more aware of the fact that as a consultant, nobody wanted to bring me in to do that because it's easy. But that doesn't mean it's unimportant. And it is important, and it is worth doing. So I probably should replace my happy face, with the suitably dignified label stakeholder engagement or public participation. Even so, I want to warn you that it's a comfortable place to be, and you want to be careful not to spend too much time there. It's worth spending some time there, but if there are people who are outraged and you're not doing outrage management, or if there are people who are apathetic and you are not doing precaution advocacy, if you are comfortably talking to interested stakeholders instead of reassuring terrified stakeholders or alarming apathetic stakeholders, then you're missing the boat. So yes, stakeholder engagement is worth doing, but it's not, the, in my judgment, the main challenge. The three main challenges are precaution advocacy, outrage management, and crisis communication. And the most important thing I want you to know about them is they are three completely different toolkits for three completely different strategies. So you have to diagnose where you are on the map in order to choose the right toolkit. Next slide, please. Nonetheless, the sweet spot is worthwhile. It's what you're doing when you're explaining policies and recommendations to journalists. And I wish CDC had done a whole lot more of that during the course of the pandemic. It's what you're doing when experts gather together to identify areas of consensus and dissensus and to discuss what further research is needed. And there should have been more of that as well. So I certainly don't want to imply that COVID didn't call for stakeholder consultation. It did. But I continue to think that the other three are the dominant paradigms. Next slide, please. So these are the four risk communication paradigms. Watch out, which is precaution advocacy. When hazard is high and outrage is low, calm down. Outrage management, when hazard is low and outrage is high. We'll get through this together. Crisis communication, when hazard and outrage are both high. And let's sit down and figure this out together. Stakeholder consultation in the sweet spot, when hazard and outrage are both intermediate. Those four are, in my judgment, the essence of risk communication. Being a good risk communicator means learning how to diagnose which of those four is called for and having a toolkit for each of those four. Next and last slide, please. These are some of my top of mind COVID risk communication gripes as of today. Some of them are directly relevant to what I've been talking about for the last hour, and they'll ring a bell. Some of them are not directly relevant, and I included them on the list in part to underline that although what I've said is, in my judgment, the most important stuff to know about risk communication, it's not everything to know about risk communication. And here are some other risk communication issues, some of which aren't about hazard and outrage. So this is my short list here. Public health professionals too often discourage and disparage dissenting expert opinion. I think we've covered that. Public health professionals too often sound overconfident and resist acknowledging their own ignorance and uncertainty. We've covered that. Public health professionals too often prioritize health over truth. We've covered that, the noble lie phenomenon. Public health professionals too often prioritize health over other values, including economic well-being, psychological well-being, and freedom. That's not something I've mentioned before, but I think it's important. The pandemic isn't a public health problem only. It is certainly a public health problem, but it is a challenge to other goods as well as the good of public health. And finding ways to compromise those priorities is something public health has done badly. Public health professionals too often conflate their policy opinions with the science. And I haven't covered that. The tendency to think everything you believe is part of your scientific professional opinion. It wasn't your professional opinion that anti-racism demonstrations were better than anti-mask demonstrations and less likely to be super spreader events. That was ideology speaking, not science speaking. Public health professionals too seldom acknowledge and apologize for things they got wrong, that I did cover. Public health professionals too often support censorship, conflating opinions they consider unwise with misinformation. I didn't cover that, but that's a big deal in my judgment. And finally, public health professionals have contributed and keep contributing to the politicization of public health. That's all I want to say. And if the timing is reasonably good, Angie, I should have left some time for questions.
You did. And let me just start out by saying thank you.